This is Learning from Genocide, a series brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. In these episodes, we will be giving a voice to just some of the incredible stories of human endurance in the face of evil. I'm Rachel Century, Head of Research for the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and over the next few weeks, as well as talking to experts who have dedicated their lives to raising awareness, we'll also be hearing from those who have survived the Holocaust and atrocities of Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur.
And there I made the greatest mistake of my life, which I regret to this very day. I allowed her to leave.
These are the first-hand stories of the people who were there and who, against all odds, survived genocide. Hello, and welcome to Learning from Genocide. In this episode, we look at the systematic killing of Black African people in Darfur, which occurred during the ongoing conflict in Western Sudan, becoming known as the first genocide of the 21st century. Today's guest, although not a survivor of genocide himself, has been posted in various regions whilst ethnic cleansing has taken place, often feeling completely helpless at the suffering around him. Dr. Mukesh Kapila is a medical professional and professor of global health and humanitarian affairs at the University of Manchester. He is a specialist in crisis and conflict management, humanitarian affairs, and post-conflict and development, and in 1994 was part of the first British teams to see the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide. In 2003 to 2004, Mukesh was the United Nations resident and humanitarian coordinator and the UN Development Programme resident representative for Sudan. It was while stationed in the region that Mukesh first became outspoken in his condemnation of the human rights abuses being committed there. And he joins me now. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mukesh.
Thank you. I'm glad that a whole new generation of people will hear about Darfur, which after all is the first genocide of the 21st century.
Well, let's get straight to it. Could you start by giving us a little bit of background to the genocide in Darfur?
There has been traditional conflict in the western part of Sudan, the region that covers Darfur, for generations. And this is when local communities who farm there come into conflict with the seasonal herders who bring in their animals for grazing. Now, traditionally, this has been settled by the older people of each group, the tribal leaders, and they resolve it through traditional community mediation techniques. They resolve it through marrying each other's women and generally finding accommodation between the demands, if you like, of different communities. What happened in around 2002, 2003 was that the traditional conflict got weaponized by the Islamic fundamentalist regime of al-Bashir in Khartoum. And the nature of the conflict became much more difficult in the sense that the Khartoum government mobilized the militia of the region and armed them with modern weaponry. So they gave them guns, machine guns. They also deployed their own air force to drop petrol bombs on the villages. And when I flew over that region in 2003, in my role as a UN coordinator, literally I could watch the destruction that was going on there. It was focused on those villages that were occupied by Darfuri groups that were more of an African origin, you know, Black Darfuri groups, as opposed to those villages which were occupied by the Arab groups. So you could see that this was ethnic targeting that was going on. Those were the early stages of what we later came to understand as a genocide.
It must have been really difficult watching it as you were flying over.
I think I was not prepared for what I saw. I had seen something like that in a different context in Rwanda in 1994, where I was a British government representative there and was the first, in fact, British official to go into Rwanda. And I had seen what the hallmark of ethnic cleansing looks like, though the technology used was different and the context was different. What we have learned about genocide is that it may take place in many places, in many contexts and cultures and continents, but there are certain distinguishing features which, regardless of time and space, show their evil head. And I could recognize the signature for genocide even in the earliest days of the Darfur conflict. And my concern at that time was to see what could be done to stop it growing into full-blown genocide. And maybe if one acted early enough, we could do something in terms of what we had promised before, not on our watch, to prevent it. Because after all, everyone was talking about prevention of these things being much better than reacting afterwards.
In the case of Darfur, it unfortunately did continue into a full-blown genocide.
Well, what happened was that the early information and data that I was collecting, you know, we're talking here about 2003 or so. We're not talking about medieval times. We are not even talking about Rwanda in 94, and we're not talking about the Holocaust of the 1940s. We're talking about the digital age. We're talking about the modern internet. We are talking about, for example, what I was doing, which is taking photographs on my smartphone. One of the first generations of smartphones were coming in. It was a BlackBerry. And I was using satellite communication systems to email those images direct to the UN headquarters in New York, to the office of Kofi Annan, direct. So never before in history have we collected information, so much of it, so quickly, so early on, and communicated it so fast to the highest levels of authority charged with doing something about it. And that, I think, when I look back, to me, that is the most egregious failure of trying to prevent a genocide, when we knew so much and could communicate so fast to the highest levels. So we can't make the excuse that we didn't know what was going on, which was the excuse that was made partly in the Holocaust and partly also in the Rwanda genocide, that, we didn't know. We only found out once we went to open the concentration camps in Germany, or in the case of Rwanda, the worst came out latest. I feel that this genocide in Darfur was a most preventable genocide. It was also a one that, even if you weren't going to be able to prevent it, because genocides are usually difficult to prevent once you are embarked on it, at least you could do enough to mitigate it.
Must have been, as you say, so frustrating to see the genocide continue to play out despite your best efforts and despite the fact that we had the technology to communicate what was happening. Can you share with us any stories of individuals or survivors that maybe somebody you met, something that stood out for you?
Indeed. I mean, other than flying over Darfur several times, I, of course, visited, you know, sat on the ground and drove around all over Darfur and met many, many people. For example, people in hospitals in Al Fasher and Niala. It was very clear, and I'm a physician by background, that the people who were sitting in these hospitals, they weren't the normal collection of civilians with the diseases you see in a deprived community in Africa. These were injured people. These were people with horrendous wounds, not just gunshot wounds, but attacked by weaponry, by knives and so on. And these were not soldiers. These were civilians. Several women who had been raped came to speak of their experience to me in some of the public meetings I held. And one in particular, I call her Aisha, as I change her name, gave me an account of her experiences when she visited my office in Khartoum. And Aisha was a young woman. She was in her late 20s, perhaps, a mother of several children. And she was in the market one day, and the Janjaweed, which are these militia groups armed by the Khartoum regime, they arrived en masse on horses and land cruisers. And there was a mass rape in that marketplace. Somewhere in the region of 120 women were raped over a couple of hours. And in the case of Aisha, she was raped in front of her father and her young sons. I heard about this when this remarkably courageous woman made her way across the burning sands of Darfur, 1,000 kilometers to Khartoum, and clamored outside my office, the UN office in Khartoum, was like all UN offices in the aftermath of the bombing of the UN office in Baghdad, very heavily protected. But she stood there outside my office and clamored for so long that the guards and my staff got so fed up. They came and said, this dirty, dusty woman wants to talk to me and won't go away. Maybe she's mad. So I said, oh, well, let her in. And she came in and sat down in my office. She told me her story and she described the whole story of how this happened. And I asked her, after being shocked by all this, what do you want me to do? One doesn't know what to say in those circumstances. And she said, I don't know. You are the United Nations. You look like a good man. I know you will do something with this. I just don't want others like me, you know, my sisters, my daughters, to be raped. Do something, she said. I'm confident you will do something. So what touched me to the core of my being, and it still brings tears to my eyes when I think of her, she had such faith. She had such a belief in the goodness and the inherent humanity of us as a world and us as international community or international institutions, in this case, the UN. And she got into absolute graphic detail about what happened to her. Now, it takes quite something for a Sudanese woman, with all the taboos that go around anything sexual, and least of all sexual violation, to tell her intimate story to a stranger and to somehow pick herself up after her multiple rape and find her way 1,000 kilometers away across a hostile landscape to a strange office. It says something, I think, about her. So then, unfortunately, I said to her, will you return tomorrow? And so we can get some of the lawyers in my office and some human rights experts, which I had with me in my office. And would you mind me recording what you say and taking your evidence as an affidavit, as part of the evidence collection in relation to Darfur, which by then was a whole crime scene. I mean, the whole of Darfur was a crime scene. I said, but meanwhile, let us look after you. You can stay here, you know, you can wash, get some food, some fresh clothes, etc. If you don't mind, I will get some experts to take down your testimony tomorrow. And then she said to me, yes, I'll come back tomorrow. Meanwhile, I want to see my relatives. I have some relatives in Omdurman, which is the old city of Khartoum. I'd like to stay with them and I will come back. And there I made the greatest mistake of my life, which I regret to this very day. Because instead of insisting she stays in the sanctuary of the UN office where she was safe, I allowed her to leave. And of course, the following day, she never turned up. 2 or 3 days later, I went to a big Darfuri refugee camp that had suddenly erupted from the sand, from the desert outside Khartoum. Literally thousands of Darfuris were fleeing Darfur. And I'd heard some rumors that there were a lot and lot of these people. They were being interned there in these alleged refugee camps. And I thought, let me see if I can find Aisha there. So along with my security and interpreters and so on, I went to this camp and both to see the place for myself and to see the other people. And most of all, to find this one woman. Because for me, by then, this one woman had come to encapsulate the whole of Darfur. So I, of course, did not find her. And how much I protested, I wrote diplomatic notes to the government. I ranted and raved at the top of my voice to anyone who would listen. I made all sorts of inquiries. I did everything I could. But I think what had happened was that the guards, the Sudanese spies, who were both in my office and probably outside the perimeter of the camp. As soon as she left, they had tailed her and probably taken her and disappeared her. And to this day, I don't know what happened to her. The following week, I went to the same camp again to see what was happening there. And, you know, I was now literally out of my mind, both feeling huge guilt, as well as huge anxiety about what had happened to Aisha and all the other Aishas. And lo and behold, the following evening, I went to the same place. It's only about 10 kilometers out of Khartoum. The whole camp had disappeared. There was nothing but the desert. And these people, these Darfuris who had fled, had been transported away. Who knows what had happened to them? Where they had been slaughtered or put in camps, which to this day, we don't know about. You can imagine that what I felt, in that here I was, the head of the biggest UN operation in the world, which is what Sudan was at that time, charged with the responsibility to protect millions, but was unable to protect one person, despite all the authority and influence one had. When you can't even protect one person, what are the chances of protecting millions? That is what triggered me. Because remember what Aisha's final words were to me as she left my office. When I asked her what I should do with her information, she said, "You will figure it out." So then I said, well, I didn't save Aisha, and God knows what happened to her, and I'm absolutely certain she perished in some horrible way. But at least I could do one thing, and that is honor her final request. After pondering in the loneliness of my office late at night, going crazy, wondering what to do, it actually became very clear. And it was an instant decision that I knew what I had to do. So the following day, I went on a plane to Nairobi, and I asked my head of media to arrange an exclusive interview with the BBC. That's when I told the whole world, on Aisha's behalf, the story of what was going on in Darfur, with all the evidence at my disposal, my own personal testimony and witness, of course. It was world headlines within minutes. And I realize now that the reason it was world headlines in minutes, because it was the head of the United Nations saying these things. If it had been a human rights organization like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty, good people saying good things, no one would listen because it's their job to advocate for such things. But when the head of the United Nations goes up and says there is ethnic cleansing going on in Darfur and that the government of Sudan was responsible for it, that then got news. One lesson I learned was it is not just what you say. It is a platform from which you speak that is important. And this is why I have never forgiven Kofi Annan or the senior officials at that time in the UN. Because imagine if someone even higher than me in the system had said these words earlier, maybe 2 months earlier, they would have had much bigger impact than me. I was so angry that my failure to save Aisha actually made me even more desperate and angry. Within about 3 months, the first peacekeepers were on the ground. But this was no consolation to either Aisha or to me, because by then the job was done. The genocide was complete. But for me, the story was finished. I was out of the country within about a month, and that was the end of my central UN career.
Thank you for sharing with us Aisha's story and honouring her memory. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what it looks like in Darfur and Sudan now. So you said you've obviously left the region. Did the violence ever really end there?
When the peacekeepers arrived, 2004, I think, by then, most of the killings were done. Most of the villages that belong to the African tribes of Darfur were decimated, and a large section were either dead or there were refugees in neighboring countries. So this is why I say the genocide was complete, because you don't measure the completion of a genocide by whether every last person is eliminated, but whether or not everyone who could be killed has been killed, and those who have not been killed have fled, and those who have not fled are incarcerated somewhere. What happened subsequently was that nothing happened for a long time. There was a rebel movement that sprang up, housed in neighboring countries like Uganda. And I myself tried to get back into Sudan, illegally, of course, because there was a price on my head. There were death threats against me. The death threats continued even when I arrived back in Europe, and I was under police protection. I'm still under some form of protection. And the rebel movements that sprung up in Darfur joined hands with the rebel movements that also sprung up in the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile, because similar things were going on in those areas as well. They're just less well publicized than in Darfur. So I visited the borderlands again. Slowly, slowly, the people of Darfur sustained their half existence. They were kept in a state of suspended animation, really. And this all changed only when the economy of the whole of Sudan went south and the military rebelled against Bashir. And of course, South Sudan broke away. And that changed the dynamics of the whole region as well. The military and Bashir in particular and the intelligence services were no longer able to maintain their control. And that led to the transition of this combined military-civil government that we have now. The military-civilian government we have now, which stabilized the country and repealed many of the terrible laws, and also started to invest in Darfur to improve the conditions of life there. And the rebel groups also started to cooperate with the authorities in return for democratic freedoms and the abolition of Islamic law. But unfortunately, the combined military-civil government, which came in under the promise that after a few years it would hand over to a civilian authority, is peopled in part by the original Janjaweed leaders. So many of the genocidaires are the ones currently in the government. And while many people were happy to close their eyes for a little while in the interests of stability for the longer term, what they had forgotten is that in the end, justice is essential for peace. You can't paper over injustices and sacrifice accountability in the name of stability and peace. So the chickens are coming home to roost now in Sudan in terms of their failure to address some of the inaccountabilities. Of course, Bashir is in jail, but Bashir is in jail not for his genocidal crimes in Darfur. He's in jail on some corruption charges and other charges. If he is released to The Hague as promised, I think Sudan is going to remain unstable. In most recent days, we have seen attempted coup by military elements who were once close to Bashir and are now part of the so-called civil military transition administration. So the job in Sudan is not done yet. And this also illustrates, I think, an important lesson for all your listeners. And that is that post-genocide, the job is never done. Post-genocide is a permanent situation where you have to constantly remember and recall, and then to set up institutions that then have to be kept forever honest and strong so that you don't slip back, which is the risk of what is happening now in Sudan. You know, the world is a terrible place, as we see from experiences everywhere that hit our screens. Unfortunately, I have lived through many of them historically. But I'm optimistic about the future. And the reason I'm optimistic is, although evil may prevail at moments in time and space, the world is also full of many, many resilient and good and stubborn people who refuse to succumb to evil. If you look at genocide history, including even before the word was invented, there is no genocide that has ever succeeded. Genocides may come close to eliminating or destroying people and their way of life. Many examples of that. But nowhere have they actually succeeded. Because sooner or later, the good people struggle back and overcome the evil. And evil will not succeed.
For information on Mukesh's books, Against a Tide of Evil and A Stranger to Kindness, you can go to his website, mukeshkapila.org. The conflict in Sudan hasn't been resolved, and so we cannot afford to take our attention away and assume that the threat of genocide there no longer exists. We continue to hear about current events in the next and final instalment of Learning from Genocide, when we look at the human rights abuses being inflicted right now on the Uyghur people in China, whilst the world stands by and watches.
Finally, my brother answered my phone call. When I asked him why no one is answering my phone call, and he said, they did the right thing. Please leave us in God's hands.
Goodbye for now. Learning from Genocide is produced by Amanda Redman and is brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust and Trafalgar Strategy. For more information on the stories that you've heard today and ways for you to be involved in what we do, please go to our website, hmd.org.uk.